The Guardian.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Mexico is mourning one of its greatest writers today. Carlos Fuentes died yesterday at the age of 83. Today he was honored at a ceremony in Mexico City's National Palace of the Arts.
Carlos Fuentes, the Mexican writer and intellectual who helped spark an explosion of Latin American literature in the 60s and 70s.
I have a novel which is narrated by a head floating in the sea cut off by the drug lords. So I have it in my own imagination. There it is. This is a talking head killed by these thugs.
I can feel him coming with that smell of incense, with his black skirts, with that hiss about in front, to bid me farewell. That is all the rigor of an admonition. I fooled them. And there's Teresa sniveling over there, and now she takes her compact out of her handbag to powder her nose so she can start sniveling again. I picture myself at the last moment. The coffin falls into the hole, and a multitude of women snivel and powder their noses over my grave. All right, I feel better.
The death of Mexican novelist Carlos Fuentes at the age of 83 last month marked a significant moment in Latin American literature. Fuentes, along with Colombia's Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Peru's Mario Vargas Llosa and Argentina's Julio Cortazar, spearheaded the 1960s Latin American boom that saw South America's literature reaching out across the continent's borders to touch readers around the globe. But with Fuentes gone and Garcia Marquez and Vargas Llosa approaching old age, the boom years are officially behind us. Today, we'll be casting an eye over Latin American literature's past and looking to where it's now heading. Alonso Cueto's The Blue Hour, set in the world of Peru's Shining Path revolutionary movement, won the Heraldo Prize when it came out in Spanish in 2005 and was published in English translation this month. On a tour of the UK to promote the novel, Cueto came in to talk to Richard Lee.
I had the idea of writing a story about the Shining Path War for a number of years, but I didn't have the story, the real characters. So one day, having lunch with a friend of mine who was doing a book about the Shining Path War, he told me about a general in the Southern Andes who had forgiven a female prisoner. They had captured this woman, they were going to rape her and kill her, but this general maybe felt sorry for her or liked her or something happened, and he kept her living with him at the fort, or the headquarters.
So basically Miriam's story.
Miriam's story, right. It meant that the most cruel and ruthless man could also be capable of an act of mercy, and the thought that he may have fallen in love with this prisoner made the whole thing interesting. So I decided to set the story a number of years later, after these events, and starting with a son who discovers that his father was a torturer and that he had forgiven a prisoner during the war. The son, the main character of the novel, discovers all this and decides to look for this girl to see what she can tell him about his father, about himself, and also maybe at the end about his country and his society and the boundaries of the world he has been living in.
Was this idea of a rediscovery, of an investigation of the past, was this something very present in your mind as you were writing? I'm thinking that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission published its findings in 2003, just a couple of years before the novel first published in Spanish.
I did a long, big research on those pages of the Truth Commission. And also, I traveled to Ayacucho, to the Southern Andes. I heard a lot of stories. My
quest and my trip to Ayacucho was similar to the one the main character does in the novel. No? You discover so many things you ignored about and that you cannot really understand. No? For instance, a woman whose husband and 12 children were killed. That's something we cannot, from our side of the world, from the side of the world of people who have at least some peace and harmony in our life, something we can't understand. No? But so this was a very, very shocking research. No, I almost got killed once because I decided that I had to take pictures from the places where the story happened. And I took a picture of the fort. And a man came out with his gun aiming at me because I was he thought I was a spy.
Nobody takes
pictures. But I told him I was a tourist.
When your character, Adrian, meets the priest in Ayacucho, the priest tells him that the people there, they don't want comfort. They want to tell their stories.
Right.
Is the Blue Hour a kind of memorial to these stories, a memorial to the victims?
A memorial to the victims and a memorial to the victims of war, but also the victims of poverty, of inequality, of all types of violence, you know, that is done to them and whose story is never told. No? One of the things, the interesting things about the Truth Commission is that people would come out and tell their stories. And telling your story is very important for you to feel better about it, no? Is that it liberates everything that you had locked inside yourself. I think that being a proven writer is a very privileged situation because we live in a country with so many different cultures that are separated and divided by ethnic, social, and cultural conflicts and racism and prejudice. And so we live in a country full of conflicts, and conflict is essential for any story. You know, nobody wants to read a story where everybody is alike, you know, or everybody gets along or everybody is happy with each other.
Because it isn't just concerned with the sins of the past. There's also another rich seam, is the divisions between the rich and poor in modern Peru. Is it telling their story as well? Is it a wake-up call to your comfortable countrymen?
Yes. Writing a novel, writing fiction, is inseparable from criticism of reality. You know, you have a critical approach to reality, and you write a story. You know, and also something you don't understand. No? Because I think that stories come when you can't explain something totally. No, in the old times, people would not understand why there was a sunset, or why there was an earthquake, or why there was rain, no? And they would tell stories to explain why these things happen, no?
No hay más vida, no hay. No hay más vida, no hay. No hay más lluvia, no hay. No hay más brisa, no hay.
We drove to the expressway, this time turning right at the statue of Mariátegui onto a dirt road, past a patch of waste ground, then turned right again and found ourselves face to face with a pack of dogs, brick walls, barred windows. The car rattled and jolted. We stopped in front of a blue house with a grill over the window and a scrawny plant held up by a cane. A black plaque with gold letters spelled out the address Jenny had given me. This was where Paulino Valle lived, the man who worked in the bodega with Miriam. I got out of the car and just stood there, unable to move. After all, what did I know about this man? And what was I going to say to him? Did you work with Miriam? Did you know her well? Did she ever mention a Comandante Ormache who kept her prisoner? Well, I'm his son, and I'm looking for her. I don't know why, but I'm here. Sure, that would be a brilliant speech. I may have been a lawyer of some standing, but now here I was, knocking on the door of some stranger called Paulino Valle, who, though he lived a few kilometers from my house, was light years from my world. I came from a different universe, from a different dimension, where people ride around in cars, sleep in king-size beds, have walk-in wardrobes filled with designer clothes. What did I have to say to him?
The city of Lima itself, with its traffic jams, the potholes, the narrow streets, the barred windows, is almost another character.
I am in love with my city, because it has so many contrasts. It's maybe not the most beautiful city in the world, but it's better that way, I think. No, it's a lesson on human societies and fellowships and contrasts and inequalities. There's been migrations from Asia and Africa and Europe, and of course the native cultures, no, and all that is a big mixture of things. All that is very exciting for a writer. Maybe it's not the best thing for the history of society, but it is for its fictional.
Looking slightly more broadly across the continent, what kind of state is Latin American literature in at the moment? In particular, I'm thinking after Mario Vargas Llosa's 2010 Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. What is this a time of experimentation, a time of opening up? Is it a time for looking back at the recent past?
There was a time in the 60s and the 70s where writers like Carlos Fuentes or García Márquez or Vargas Llosa wrote about their own countries. And the readers, you know, in Europe, for instance, would see their novels as an expression of their countries. O sea, they saw Colombia in García Márquez and Mexico in Fuentes or in Rulfo and Peru in Vargas Llosa. I don't think that happens as much anymore. I think that after Bolaño, the literature is not being as realistic as it was. But I'm still interested in what happens in reality. I think reality is extremely rich and stimulating. And in a country like Peru, where there is a new social class, there's the emergent class, no, and people who are sons of immigrants who were once poor are now wealthy, go to the same schools as the sons and daughters of the rich traditional people, and they are getting married and they are getting together. I think that's very interesting still for a writer. But I think the people who are younger than I are not interested in much of that anymore, and they're writing fiction that is set in different countries or in different atmospheres or very, very intimate and personal.
It's moved beyond the national to a kind of global.
I think that's what's happening right now. Young writers, no, very young writers are not interested. No? And also, I understand that, because I'm interested in what happens in my country, but I don't think that you need to be interested or talk about your country's problems in a novel. No? A friend of mine who is a Colombian writer was telling me recently, well, I'm not interested in drug trafficking or the FARC, but I'm interested in other things, and I'm still a Colombian writer, so why shouldn't I write what I'm interested in? I think the situation now is a more varied and more different type of writers, no, than it was in the 60s, when all of them were kind of, even the magic realism was kind of an expression of the reality of the country, because the reality was magical also. No? On the other hand, I feel passion for what is going on. I still believe in human beings as inspirers of the best stories. No? I've always thought that a good story, it has to do with what happens to somebody in a moment of challenge or of risk in his life. I never felt tempted to write about other books or to do meta-literature. I think literature has to do with people, with what they like, what they love, what they are willing to die for. And those are the real stories. I mean, that way, in that sense, a very 19th century writer. You know?
So back to reality.
back to reality, exactly.
Alonso Cueto there, making his case that all literature, not just South American, should avoid being too inward-looking. Ingrid Behrman is Latin America consultant for the Montreal Books Festival, so is well-versed in what's going on in the literature now. But she also worked for Carlos Fuentes before he died. So on the line from Canada, I asked her to tell me what he was like.
Oh, it was fantastic. I worked actually for him and with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. They have a chair of Latin American affairs in Guadalajara, Mexico. And I was the director of the activities of the chair. It was, as I said, a fantastic experience in every sense of the word.
Okay. How did you come to have that job?
Actually, because I was working for Gabriel Garcia Marquez before in Colombia. He has a foundation for journalists and I was a program coordinator there. I'm a journalist by training. And because I'm from Brazil and I also speak Spanish, it was a nice way to also integrate Brazil, which normally gets left out from these types of activities. Brazil being like a sort of continent on its own in every Latin American milieu. So I came from Colombia to Mexico.
And obviously, we know a lot about Fuentes through his literature, but what was he like as a man? What was he like as a boss?
It was amazing to just be in his presence. He would talk about literature, as someone talks about the weather, in a very expected way. But it was also very interesting to hear all the things that his colleagues, the intellectuals in Latin America that were visiting the chair, would say, the anecdotes that they had to tell about Fuentes. Stories, you know, for instance, Derek Walcott once told me that that he bumped into him in a Miami hotel. They were in the corridor, and then Walcott bowed to him in respect as a joke, and then Fuentes threw himself on the floor. You know, he had a huge sense of humor. It was a lot of fun to hear those stories. It was also a lot of fun to just be in his presence. He was a very imposing, you know, man, looked like a diplomat, sort of like a diplomat professor, you know, extremely erudite, extremely cultured, but also very humble, surprisingly enough, you know.
And what was your reaction on hearing about his death?
Very, very sad, because it was completely unexpected. We've seen Garcia Marquez is sort of deteriorating his health in the past 15 years, but Fuentes had been very, very healthy up until the night before, and I was extremely shocked and very, very sad.
And Fuentes and Garcia Marquez and Mario Vargas Llosa, they together sort of spearheaded the Latin American boom in the 1960s. Can you tell us a bit about that? Why did Latin American literature explode so vigorously at that point?
Well, actually, Fuentes had a crucial role in that, because he was a Mexican ambassador in Paris, and a lot of the intellectuals would go into exile because they were speaking against their governments in the 1960s, and so he would host them in Paris and then even help them arrange for positions in other countries, namely Mexico. Mexico received a lot of the other Latin American intellectuals, and so the Paris scene was very hot in terms of the literature that was going there, with authors like Garcia Marquez, Carlos Fuentes Vargas Llosa, and also Julio Cortázar, Juan Rulfo. Was a fantastic scene, but that was in the 60s when magic realism was exploding as a genre, and but Latin America was still sort of seen with a sort of a curious type of magical, mystical continent. And I think now the new generation of Latin American writers hopes to, you know, sort of change that and actually write about the problems and the realities of Latin America of the 21st century that are not those of the fantasy world of people flying through the air and sort of thing.
Why do you think it was that magical realism and Latin America became so continent? Why was it that it was in this place that people were talking about coming up with stories in which people did suddenly start flying through the air, or, you know, cats take over a village or whatever?
Garcia Marquez himself says that because we lack resources, we have a lot of imagination. So, but actually at the same time, he says that magic does happen, that if you actually live in the Caribbean, these kinds of, because this is not just a Latin American thing, but also in the Caribbean, which he would include New Orleans, Louisiana, actually as part of that, that this sort of magic actually does happen, that magic is part of reality as well. And so it was very present, I guess, in the whole, in his life and in the lives of the people there. But I think now that's sort of part of our heritage. But I think now we're moving towards other aspects of the literature that are more interesting, and sort of trying to move away from that.
What are those aspects you think we're moving towards?
Well, I think actually talking about the realities of Latin America, not only violence and poverty, but also just the peculiarities of this generation that are more in tune with what is going on, say, in the 21st century. But also, I think mostly the rebellion is not so much against, of this generation rather, they're not so much rebelling against what they call the grandfathers of the 60s, which would be Fuentes and Garcia Marquez, but more against the parents, which would be, say, Laura Esquivel and Isabel Allende, who actually borrowed from magic realism and just stayed there. They're actually hoping to move away from this. And there's mainly two big movements. One, the crack generation in Mexico, which actually hopes to crack away, to break away from the boom. And Fuentes himself actually, he very actively promoted that movement, calling it the Junior Boom. And in Chile, the movement's called Mac Hondo, like as in Mac Hondo, the magical world of Garcia Marquez, but it's spelled in the McDonald's way, like M-C-O-N-D-O. Like it's a play on Mac Hondo and McDonald's. And as well, like hoping to break away from that just trail of magic realism that's just been recycled over and over, and it's just not new and offers nothing in terms of all the things that can be offered right now.
So do you think our idea of what Latin American literature is set to change then?
Yeah, actually, they deliberately want to break away from the expectation, the European expectation of what they offer. As a matter of fact, they don't want to be seen as remote anthropological objects for observation, but they want to actually rather create their own world. And as a matter of fact, they actually write about Europe or actually set their novels in Europe as well. Like you have Jorge Volpe, for instance, who wrote a novel called Looking for Klingsor that actually takes place during World War II and a little bit afterwards. And it's a thriller involving German nuclear physicists, which is actually a fantastic, fantastic book. And also Ignacio Padilla and Vicente Errasti also both have novels that are set in Europe as well, which is a very interesting contrast, to say one thing, vis-a-vis, say, the boomers. Although you did have Cortázar also. Cortázar would write about Paris and Buenos Aires, but that's a very strong connection between the two cities. And Buenos Aires is sort of like a separate city in Latin America. It's more European and never aspired to be Latin American in that respect. But I think that what they want to move away from is just the expectation that they're just going to be the magic realism and the same old narrative that gets repeated over and over again. And especially, namely, in the works of, and not to criticize him, but Isabel Allende and The House of the Spirits literally is a remake of 100 Years of Solitude. And they really want to break away from that pattern and that expectation.
So who should we be looking out for then? Who are the people who are now rising up the ranks as in the wake of Fuentes' death and as Garcia Marquez and Vargas Llosa get older? Who's next?
Okay, well, as I mentioned, there's that new generation of Mexicans, the crack generation. So when Jorge Volpi, Ignacio Padilla, and Vicente Errasti are fantastic writers. Also, Pedro Ángel Palú and Juan Villoro they're amazing writers as well. It's hard to sort of describe them in one sentence. Their literature offers a whole new world to discover, a whole set of writing and that's very different, innovative. And it's not, if anything, it borrows from Kafka, say, in the tradition of that sort of level of imagination, but not from magic realism. And also in Bogota, in Colombia, actually has a very hot scene as well. And again, you can't really escape the shadow of Garcia Marquez, because the Hay Festival actually has a festival in Cartagena, which is his hometown. But at the same time, you can sort of see it taking off. The Hay Festival promoted a group called Bogota 39, which are the 39 writers of Latin America under 39. And I strongly suggest the British writers to go and check that list out. It's on the Hay Festival's website. And I would agree that all of the 39 writers that they selected are pretty, pretty fantastic. Then the Colombians, I would single out definitely Juan Gabriel Vasquez and his book The Secret History of Costaguana, which again he deliberately wants to do away with the whole business of Latin America as a magical continent. And you'll see what that is about. Again, The Secret History of Costaguana, I strongly suggest that book. And a lot of excitement also in Peru. Peru has actually, it's unfortunate that it's not in English, but they have a magazine called Etiqueta Negra, which means black label, sort of like a riff on the whiskey, that publishes very, very, very the finest narrative journalism that I've seen probably in the world. Not only from Latin America, they published Richard Kapuscinski and Susan Orlean, but all of Latin American writers as well, as a fantastic magazine based in Peru, but includes all of Latin America, and also is, as I mentioned, a lot of the writers there are not from Latin America, actually from outside. And Alonso Cueto is excellent, as is Santiago Roncagliolo. Like, both of them won major prizes in the first part of the 20th century, in the 2006, 2007. They won major literary prizes, and obviously Vargas Llosa then wins the Nobel in 2010. And then you also have Jaime Bailey, who is actually now a Miami-based broadcaster, who's a television personality as well as a writer. He's known to be sort of like a cocaine-snorting, bisexual sort of whole persona. He's very, very good looking as well, very articulate, very funny to and interesting to see on the TV, but also his novels are also very, very good. A lot of the homosexual youth actually followed him in the coming out process, especially because Lima is an extremely conservative city, so a figure like him actually is quite causes a lot of controversy, which is fun to watch as well. And there's other things as well. There's Janina Braski, who writes in Spanglish. You know, she actually wrote the first Spanglish novel, arguably in the literature, called Yo-Yo Boing. And also United States of Banana. It's a very fun read that chronicles the Latin American immigrants' experiences in the United States. Very innovative, sort of talking about the duality of identities in Latin America, especially their relationship to the United States, but not in the 60s, rather just the immigrants and all this other richness, like the cultural exchanges of languages and the duality of speaking two languages. That's all new stuff and very interesting, has a lot more to offer than just, as I mentioned, following the trail of magic realism.
And we saw the world becoming fascinated with Latin America in the late 20th century with Latin American literature. What do you think the standing of the literature is going to be internationally in the 21st century, looking forward?
Oh, I think there's a lot of books that are being translated and a lot of exposure now thanks to, you know, the internet. The word really gets out there in terms of what's new. And also you have things like editions of prestigious magazines that are being edited on the industry level. Like you have editions of Granta in Portuguese in Brazil and in Spanish that also help to promote, I mean, help facilitate that exchange in ways that that are sort of unprecedented. And the literary festivals also that are in place, not only with the Hay Festival in Cartagena, but also major cities in Latin America have fantastic festivals where they invite a lot of writers from abroad, but also showcase a lot of the local stuff. And then the foreign writers get to meet the locals and then promote them abroad. So there's a lot of that going on. And so it's a lot easier to spread the word right now than it was, you know, say 20 years ago. One of the things that I think the world has yet to discover, as I mentioned previously with the magazine Black Label, Etiqueta Negra, is the long tradition of narrative nonfiction writing and narrative journalism. Actually, Garcia Marquez himself he refers to himself as a journalist more than a writer, and he sees journalism as a literary genre. And so what the Americans say would call the new journalism is something that has existed for almost 100 years in Latin America, and that actually is a tradition of reportage that that Latin American writers do. And all the novelists are also journalists. So I think through that hook of nonfiction, I think a lot more other things can get translated and then exposed, you know, starting with a short reportage, then moving on to books. You know, I think that there's a lot of potential, and I think that that actually is happening. And it's very exciting, at least for me, because obviously I'm a huge fan and a promoter of all this wonderful stuff.
And we'll be putting Ingrid Behrman's full reading list on our page at guardian.co.uk/books. Click on the podcast button at the top. And while you're there, if you haven't already, do subscribe to have the podcast delivered to your computer every week. It's well worth it. Well, we've heard plenty about fiction from Latin America, but what about the continent's poetry? With me now in the studio is poet Fiona Sampson. Fiona, when we're talking about Latin American poetry, what is it exactly that we're talking about? Is it just poetry that's written in Latin America, or does it have some styles and subjects that are particular to it?
No, it does have a trajectory of its own. It has a specific history. I think it's very remarkable that Latin American poetry came into its own at the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, as it were 100 years after the European poetry, the movement of national poets, which corresponded with the rise of the nation state in Europe. Of course, it corresponded with the rise of the nation state in Latin America too, after imperialism. So I think the big question for Latin American poetry from the outset was, who are we? Yeah. And because they weren't doing what European poets like Prescherin or Eminescu were doing in the sense of forming a national language, because they had already huge literary languages, Spanish, Portuguese, what they were doing was creating a cultural identity, a slightly different thing, which meant that their disruption of strict forms and their movement into what they call modernismo happened much earlier than it happened in Europe and North America.
And modernismo is distinct from modernism, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Modernismo is not modernism. Modernismo is, roughly translated, chromaticism. It's just like the end of Romanticism in European music and poetry, that kind of extension into symbolism, in fact. The father of Modernismo was Ruben Dario, who was Nicaraguan. He suddenly produced this book called Azul in 1888, which was incredibly influenced by his reading of French poets Gautier, the symbolist Verlaine in particular. And then Modernismo became a continent-wide movement because it had a kind of flexibility and generosity. I mean, one thing to bear in mind is that Latin American, throughout the 20th century and still now, is overwhelmingly free verse. And really, that's the result of the late, as it were, anti-imperial 19th century poets, people like José Martí, Cuban poet, who translated Whitman. And Whitman's had a disproportionate influence, as it were, on Latin American poetry, I think because, you know, the revelation of free verse and his distinctive long lines, but also Whitman's kind of superabundance. You see that a lot. And that fed well, very well into Modernismo, which is very Baroque.
And so let's talk a bit about the 20th century then and what happened to the poetry over that period of time. When we were talking about this on Twitter yesterday, we asked people, you know, tell us, you know, what's your favourite Latin American poetry? Pretty much 90% of people came back and said, Neruda, Pablo Neruda, he's absolutely brilliant, which of course is the case.
I mean, of course Neruda is a standout figure. I'd say there were three, really. There's Neruda, but 10 years before him, there's Cesar Vallejo, Peruvian, and then 10 years after him, there's Octavio Paz, Mexican, and all three of them have made that transition into being kind of influencing world poetry. Mm-hmm. But as for why Neruda, all three of those figures were very influenced by the Spanish Civil War and by Marxism and by a sense of responsibility to the whole human community. Mm-hmm. Neruda made a very specific commitment to write for everybody.
Which, again, is a Whitman-esque position.
It is, isn't it? Well, I mean, some of his collection titles, like Canto General, I mean, that's an incredibly Whitman-esque title, isn't it? The Song of Everything. But I think that that meant that he uses symbols, which are very big symbols, and also very easily read. There's no mystification, there's no sophistry, there's no cool. He speaks very strongly, and he speaks very widely. And if you, for example, you know the late poem Poetry, and it ends, I wheeled with the stars, my heart broke loose on the wind. Well, can you imagine a contemporary Anglo-American poet writing like that? No one would dare.
And that's absolutely an opening out and a kind of welcoming in.
It is, exactly. It's very welcoming. And what a trajectory from the kind of Verlaine, you know, I mean, he was a prodigy and very famous already with his second collection when he was 19, Crepusculario. And then when he was 20, the 20 Poems of Love and Song of Despair, really famous poems like Tonight I Can Write the Saddest Lines, when he was 20. But then all through the 30s and 47, his Residence on Earth, those three collections, the last one, OK, is also inflected by Spanish Civil War, but they're praise poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's a hugely inclusive thing to be doing. I mean, you know, they might be praising the fact there's a lizard, or they might be praising the fact he's in love, but they are, that's a very, as you say, a very welcoming kind of gesture.
We're talking about the ways in which Latin American poetry is similar to American poetry. But what about the things that divides it? The fact that this poetry is written in Spanish or Portuguese. Is there stuff that we're missing? Does it matter?
I don't think we're missing things word by word or image by image, necessarily. It's possible that what we're missing is not the sensibility either, but the project. Mm. You know, the idea of how do you say that we are equal to what's European? We are as sophisticated, and therefore in some way we are taking the Europeans as our model, but we're not being European. And I think that what's interesting is that after Modernismo in the 20th century came Vanguardismo. I do love the names of Latin American movements. And so a rebellion against, it's a kind of, okay, so let's do something different. And that was all sorts of things. So with the Cuban Revolution, it was colloquialismo.
Oh, this is brilliant. I didn't know any of this.
And before the Cuban Revolution, before Modernismo went over to Cuba, there was negrista, which is very interesting for us. That's people like Nicolas Guillen, because it's a return to, it's trying to say, let's strip away all that was European, and somehow saying Modernismo is, you know, bourgeois, decadent, European. And let's go back to a sort of Afro-Spanish dialect. It didn't last very long because people didn't want to see themselves as sons of the soil, as it were. But what's interesting about that is that it's exactly the opposite of negritude and what Aimé Césaire was doing, which was trying to bring the sophistication of modernism to the Caribbean. On Cuba, also in the Caribbean, they were jettisoning that kind of European style. So I think that's very interesting. And also there was ultraismo.
They're just making it up, aren't they?
And ultraismo was a movement co-founded by Borges in Spain, interestingly, sort of 1918. But it didn't last. It didn't outlast its own magazine, which was called Ultra. Ultra folded in 22, but Borges obviously came back home and continued writing ultraismo poetry. And ultraismo poetry was not modernismo, so it was quite influenced by futurism and Dada and surrealism. And what all those movements do isn't it, that they try and just look at the image itself, the idea, the symbol, the metaphor, throwaway conjunctions, extra phrases, decoration, and it just returned the poem to the central metaphor.
So where has this left us all now, then, 12 years into the 21st century?
Well, I think what's interesting is that obviously, in a sense, so much went on then that Latin American poetry still seems to be digesting that. I mean, there are new things happening. There are creative writing courses on university campuses, and, you know, there is some performance poetry, particularly performance poetry, Hispanic performance poetry in North America, but which is identifying itself as Latin American. But really, the most interesting poets are all still digesting the influences of, as it were, modernismo and modernism. A Cuban poet, José Cuza, who has lived all his adult life in the States, quite recently, in the beginning of this century, published a collection called Anima. And Anima is a sequence of poems, all of them with the title Anima. So it's about some aspect of his psyche, which of course means it's symbolism, crudely interpreted, but full of course, imagery from the natural world, because that's something else that characterizes a lot of Latin American poetry. And then poets born in the 60s, like the Chilean Andrés Morales and the Mexican Elvia Ardalani, both of them are quite inflected by myth, so that Morales, his last collection was Sibyl poems, and Ardalani's, in 2007, she wrote a long poem about the death of her father called Ash Wednesday. And it is very biblical in sort of tone as well as in its references. And not a peer, but another Mexican, so born earlier again, born in the 40s, is Gloria Jervitz, who is a Jewish Mexican poet, who she wrote a book called Migrations, which was published in 2003. It took her 30 years to write, and it is a huge, wow, long poem. And it is extraordinarily long lines. Sometimes the long lines almost lapse into prose poetry, very symbol-led. The symbols don't necessarily add up to a neat package. In other words, there's clearly a lot of modernismo working its way through, but it's not archaic or arch. It's very, one might say, passionate, and again, full of images from the natural world.
That's an awful lot of reading we've now set up for you, from Mexico to Peru. What else have you got to look forward to from Guardian and Observer Books this week? In The Guardian's review on Saturday, continuing our Latin American theme, Mario Vargas Llosa talks to Stuart Jeffries about his new novel about Roger Casement, The Dream of the Celt, winning the Nobel, and why he punched Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And on Bloomsday, which is of course Saturday, Colm Toybin follows in Joyce's footsteps with a tour of Dublin. And in the new review in The Observer on Sunday, Richard Ford talks about his new novel, Canada. And that's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Fiona Sampson, Ingrid Bayerman, Alonso Cueto and Richard Lee. I'm Sarah Crown and our producer was Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
Poetry by Pablo Neruda. And it was at that age poetry arrived, in search of me. I don't know. I don't know where it came from winter or a river. I don't know how or when. No, they were not voices. They were not words, nor silence. But from a street I was summoned, from the branches of night, abruptly from the others, among violent fires or returning alone. There I was without a face, and it touched me. I did not know what to say. My mouth had no way with names. My eyes were blind, and something started in my soul. Fever or forgotten wings, and I made my own way, deciphering that fire. And I wrote the first faint line, faint, without substance, pure nonsense, pure wisdom of someone who knows nothing. And suddenly I saw the heavens unfastened and open. Planets, palpitating plantations, shadow perforated, riddled with arrows, fire and flowers. The winding night, the universe. And I, infinitesimal being, drunk with the great starry void, likeness, image of mystery, felt myself a pure part of the abyss. I wheeled with the stars. My heart broke loose on the wind.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio. Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.